Welcome back to Fear or Favour. So we're now with you every other week. Nazir and I talking about things that are topical, crime, and we also have guests, and we've got a guest to get today. But just before we start, Nazir, how's your week been?
It's been brilliant. My son graduated with a first class honours. So that was absolutely fantastic. In a couple of days' time, I'm going to be doing the Commonwealth Games baton bearing. So I'm going to be running for 200 metres, so I may not be available for the next podcast or any future podcast if I don't survive 200 metres in 40 degrees sunshine. But it's all good. Absolutely.
Brilliant. Fun. And of course, a very big time for children this time of year compared to last year and the year before, when, of course, COVID had a huge impact, not just in relation to their studying, but their mental health. And it stopped them from being able to do the very simple things. You know, graduation ceremonies is a big thing.
My son spent a whole year in his student accommodation, for which he was paying a lot of money, not doing all his lectures online. And, you know, I can imagine, I can't imagine how that must have been. But he got there, he's done it. As he said to me yesterday, Dad, I'm not a student anymore, I'm now unemployed. And I thought, right, okay, what next?
And I think we often forget, as parents, the impact that education has on children, and particularly that COVID had on them. It was very easy. There was an awful lot talked about in relation to adults and the impact on them. But I really think we forgot at times
the
impact on children.
We have.
So that really takes us into what we want to talk about today and our very kind guest that has joined us. But before I set the scene, one of the areas that we've talked about quite a bit is the impact of pornography on children and how they view it online and what that means. And as a result of that, we've reached out to Carolyn from Internet Matters to really come on board and talk us through not just some of the issues that exist, but crucially what can be done about it. And Nazir, it's one of those areas that I think a lot of people just shy away from talking about.
Well, we shy away, but children don't shy away. They're discussing it all the time. Carolyn will tell us in a moment, the ready access that children have. I think there was a research not long ago, 11 to 16-year-old girls, two-thirds of them said they've been sent dick pics. There is a real, tsunami of pornography available, particularly for our young, readily accessible on all their digital devices. I remember when I prosecuted one particular guy in the late 90s, and he had about 7,500 images of children, indecent images of children. A couple of years later, I prosecuted another guy who had 2.5 million. That's the speed with which availability, accessibility, and ultimately impact has grown.
I know when I certainly started investigating it, it was VHS cassettes that the material was collected on. Now, of course, then it moved to floppy disks, and now it moved to very simple memory cards, and memory cards that can store millions of images and are very, very small. Carolyn, thanks for joining us. Before we start, just tell us, what is Internet Matters? Why did you create it?
So Internet Matters was formed back in 2014. By the four internet service providers that we have in the UK, so BT, Sky, Virgin Media and TalkTalk. And they were at the time under a bit of pressure because pornography was very easy to access in the home. You know, they literally children could be two or three clicks from extreme pornography. And so the government wanted them to introduce something called filtering on home broadband that would prevent children from doing that, and also asked them to develop a campaign to promote awareness of that to parents. What was born out of that, I think mostly because the CEOs were parents and they cared about the subject, was actually a commitment to create a joint venture, an independent joint venture together, and to fund that initially for 3 years, to give it some time to grow, to actually see how it could work in that space and to actually really support parents and families with all of their children's online issues. And so that's how Internet Matters was formed. You know, we're 8 years on, 9 years on, we are a leading provider of information for support for parents across all ranges of issues. We also provide support for professionals and educators in the classroom. And we see consistently that pornography, sexting, grooming are some of the top concerns that parents have in this space. And we hopefully provide parents with some information and some support and some ideas and tips that they can do with their children to try and help their children, when they come across these risks, make sure those risks don't turn into actual harmful behaviour.
And of course, the two major places where children can be spoken to about it, who gain their education, is at school, but also at home. Let's tackle them individually. What is done at school to educate children? I mean, it's quite difficult sometimes for parents to sit down and have that conversation with their children about it. Easier for a teacher. But of course, the teacher then has to be engaged and be in a position where the children will listen. How does that work and what's happening at schools?
Yeah, I mean, it's improved significantly, certainly from when I was at school. We have a formal relationship education and relationship sex education curriculums for both primary and secondary, and they've been improved in the last couple of years. A new curriculum came into force in September 2022. And so certainly the standard and the way that sex education is being taught is much, much improved in schools. I'm a mum to twin boys that are 13, and they've had the full, at 13, they've already had the sort of full remit of sex education. So it is much improved.
What age did that start now?
It starts back in primary. Yeah. They were learning about how babies were born in year five, year six of primary. So they're very open about going through the differences between men and women and, you know, sexual organs and sexual processes. And they're all, they are taught in an age appropriate way. And I think, you know, that is it. As children come home and inevitably talk to their parents about what they learned at school that day, I think that's a real opportunity for parents to basically not shy away from those conversations and actually carry on those conversations so that it becomes a little bit easier to talk to some of the other stuff that we might want to talk to our children about as they grow up.
Just on that, Carolyn, I mean, I know there's a lot of sensitivity, particularly in some cultures, to have those conversations as early as possible. I remember, having a battle on behalf of Birmingham City Council when some activists were outside a primary school in Birmingham, if you remember, that was teaching about LGBT issues. So what's the effort? What effort do we need to keep? We have to be obviously very relentless on this, but we're fighting a battle here, aren't we? There's some people who just don't want to have this conversation taking place in schools. And you mentioned, I think year five, that's like 10 years old, isn't it? There are rape victims at 9 or 10. There are children who give birth, amazingly, at 10, 11. So the earlier we have these conversations, the safer the children will be. But unfortunately, there are some people within our communities and within our society that don't want those conversations to be had in the school.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think parents do have a right, I think, to take their children out of education, certainly in primary school. I think it's mandatory in secondary school. I'd have to go and check that. I think it is difficult. And I think the more open we can be about it, the better it will be for outcomes for young people. You know, young people live in a very sexualized society. You know, I'm minded that Love Island is on at the moment, you know, and there we have on mainstream television people walking around in bikinis and toned bodies and making out and all the rest of it. And I think we really have to accept that young people need to be guided into, you know, the right behaviors and what's appropriate, what consent means, you know, how they should be treating each other with respect. And I think it's just I think schools play a hugely important role in that. But I think, you know, certainly parents equally have lots that they can do in this space to instill the right values in their children.
Just on the schools, from what I know, that the content seems to be very good. It's always about the delivery, isn't it? Delivery, delivery, delivery. You're expecting a very busy teacher with an enormous amount to deliver in terms of, you know, all the curriculum. And then they also have to deliver this. I understand why that's the case, because, you know, a teacher is a very trusted person. So the child might pay more attention to what a teacher says than anybody else, for that matter. But sometimes it might be a rather difficult conversation to have between French and geography, for example. You know, there's a case, is there not, for having specialist deliverers coming in, going into school. Obviously, we have to pay for it. Government has to pay for it. But people who are the NGOs, you know, like organizations like yourself, going in and delivering this rather than expecting teachers to do so.
Yeah, and a lot of schools do choose to do that and bring in outside third parties to help. I think this is just, you know, it's symptomatic of the way teachers are completely overloaded. And I think we see this in all of our work on online harms. You know, children, a lot of the online harms that they might experience are related to their peer groups and related to the relationships that they might have in schools, whether that's bullying, whether that's sexting, you know, whether it's, you know, activity on social media, what they're sharing. And I think, you know, certainly in our research with teachers, we feel teachers tell us that they just feel that they aren't equipped and don't have the right knowledge to be able to support young people necessarily. And so they're really crying out for more support, more help, tailored resources, things that they can take off the shelf, because they're just so busy trying to deliver, you know, a massive curriculum and a catch-up curriculum because of the last 2 years of the pandemic. So things like online safety and things, you know, the softer sort of things that are being taught in school tend to get left a little bit behind and perhaps not given the focus that they really deserve and that they need.
Carolyn, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts in terms of sexualization. So I think society now is far more sexualized than it was. You only need to look at television and see that the way that particularly women, you know, portrayed and portrayed in the media. How do you think that affects, and what's the knock-on effect on the internet as a result of that? Bearing in mind, you know, children will use the internet very much more in a private environment, away from perhaps watching television.
Yeah, I think it's a huge issue. I mean, you know, we were going to talk about pornography this morning, but the you know, a lot of the pornography that is readily available, it is very violent, very abusive towards women. It demonstrates, you know, activities that you perhaps don't want your children, like strangulation, you know, and beating and being slapped. And it's just, it's really not what we want our young people to be seeing. And I think, you know, it's that sort of slippery slope, isn't it, of kind of, you know, what starts as bikinis and everything else on mainstream gets worse and worse on the internet. And I think that's essentially what we see. And then you have the other side of it, where you have the sexualization that really particularly affects boys and girls and boys, but just that whole that pressure to be body perfect and the pressure to be beautiful. Because what you're seeing in mainstream media is that all women, you know, have wonderfully white teeth, you know, perfect breasts, a thigh gap, you know, flat tummy. And in reality is a lot of us aren't like that, you know, and yet that's what our young people are seeing more and more of in on the internet, you know, on social media platforms. And so we're also seeing this rise in self-harm and eating disorders, you know, as a result of both young girls and young boys who have the opposite with about buffing up and having a six pack. They're really struggling with some of that, and it's really affecting their mental health. And I think, you know, again, trying to get the education right by both parents and by teachers to say that, you know, this is social media. They're portraying the very best of themselves. They've spent 2 hours editing the image. They've taken 200 images to get the one that they've chosen. We have to explain that to young people so that they don't feel that they're judging themselves all the time by what they see.
And how do we do that? And that's absolutely the case, isn't it? You know, young children now growing up, they use social media platforms to post their photographs, and it's an integral part of their life. You know, they have to post one every day. You know, they share them with their friends, things. But how do you tackle that in terms of talking to children? You know, what age do you start to talk to children, and how do you educate them about the safety elements of that and what that means for them and their body?
Yeah, I mean, we say it's never too early to talk. You know, parents will give children, you know, I always think back and say, my thing is, it starts with Peppa Pig on YouTube, you know, because when they're 2, 3, you're handing over a device and you're allowing them to interact with content. It's so important to talk to children, whatever the age. And there's, you know, we focus on really encouraging children to think critically about what they're seeing online. You know, children have an inherent belief that they read something and think it's true. And so I think it's our job to point out, or they see something and it's true. I think it's our job as parents to just keep reminding them about what they're looking at and what they're reading and what they're seeing, and that they should really think about that. Try and ask the right questions. Is it true? Is it right? You know, you know, has this person, as I say, spent hours manipulating a photo? Is the person I'm talking to who they say they are? You know, as basic as that. You know, those are the kinds of things, just to encourage our children to be questioning what they see online, and as parents to be basically prompting them and staying engaged. You know, the biggest thing that we've seen in our research with parents is that if the parents and the children are aligned in their understanding of, for example, what the family rules are. So if children say, here's my family rules, and parents say, yep, those are the family, you know, they match. If they parents can explain the experiences their young people are having because they're in touch with them, for those children, their well-being in, and their safety online is so significantly higher than for those that they aren't. So our biggest message to parents is be a nosy parent. Get engaged in what your children are doing. You know, if your child walked out the door, you would say, where are you going? Who are you meeting? What time are you going to be back? Yeah. When they go online, you need to think about it in the same way, is what are you looking at? Who are you talking to? You know, and make sure that you're aware.
Isn't one of the major problems that parents just aren't up to date with technology, don't necessarily understand it, have so much going on in their own lives that they just don't spend the time talking to their children?
I think just before you speak, Karen, to add on to what Mark said, I mean, there's a link with deprivation. If you've got two jobs, because you need to pay the rent and feed the bills, you're going to give the tablet to your child, just get on with it. And you don't have, as a parent, you don't have the time. How does one deal with that?
I totally agree with that. The other key strand of our work is around supporting vulnerable young people, because online harm, so whether that's accessing pornography or sharing sexual images or being groomed, disproportionately affects the most vulnerable children in society. So to your point, Nazir, you know, if you've got working parents or parents that aren't in a position to look after their children, it's those vulnerable children in care. Those children experience online harms at 5, 6, 7 times the rate that a typical child would experience harm. So it's vital we try and support we call it the rainbow of adults that support vulnerable young people. So whether that's counsellors, social workers, you know, Senkos in schools, teachers in schools, parents themselves, vital that we educate and empower those people to be aware of young people's online lives and to be able to intervene if they see risky situations developing. And that's a real strand of our work. We actually lead a group of 20 voluntary organisations that are just because we all feel it's so important that we're all just trying to work together to raise the standards in that space.
I mean, that is the real challenge, isn't it? I mean, you will know from the work I did previously around grooming gangs, etc., and the deprived and vulnerable children, is that they are often not listened to. I mean, they've just been ignored. And yeah, if you remember last year, Caroline, there was that portal, Everyone's Invited.
But
that's right, where young people were, for the first time, thousands of them were sharing how they were suffering peer-on-peer abuse, how they weren't being listened to, how when they did raise a concern, people just didn't have time to deal with it. So, I mean, firstly, pay tribute to what you're trying to do here, bringing everybody together, work in this space. But we need an army of parents. Obviously, you can't say this, but you know, you need more resources in this area. The reality is that you know, the Online Harms Bill, which, as you know, is going through government parliament right now, is now stalled. And there was a section in there about age verification, for example, which very supportive of. But it means that, you know, it doesn't seem to be a government priority. It doesn't seem to be anybody's priority except for yours and the voluntary sector, who are trying to skill up young people to be able to deal with the challenges they face.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's sad that we feel that the responsibility lies with children to look after themselves. It shouldn't be. Yes, we're doing what we're doing to help parents, but we're doing that in the absence of effective regulation, in the absence of tech that's been designed for young people to use so that it's safe to use, you know. And you know, it is a real shame that the bill has stalled, but it's also such a long time coming, you know. I think 2 years ago that we were going to have AV and age verification on porn websites, and everyone was set up to do it, and it got dropped because we were going into an election and didn't feel like the right thing to do to turn off porn for the entire adult population in the UK. You know, and thankfully it's been put back in, but you know, the bill, there's a we really need the bill to be enforced, and we really need, you know, internet companies to take more responsibility in this place. You know, if they've got young people on their platforms, they should be in a space where they can be safe and protected.
But Carolyn, herein lies one of the problems, isn't it? Because it's all well and good saying legislation. You're absolutely right. Legislation should have been brought in a long time ago. But it's the very people who create these sites, who manage these sites, who could quite easily say, well, we're just going to put age verification on. You know, so the industry itself clearly yep. needs to do more. And I'm not asking you to bash the industry and anyone in particular, but it still needs to do more, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're in a difficult position because we're, as a not-for-profit, a lot of our funding comes from industry. You know, that there's not money coming from government and it's difficult to fundraise. So a lot of our programmes we do with industry partners. But they do need to do more and they do need to step up. And some are being more progressive than others. I think we've seen all of them introduce certainly new features and tools since the there was another piece of legislation what's called the Children's Code, but it's the Information Commissioner's Age Appropriate Design Code, which was basically about children's privacy and data and how that was managed. And actually, we saw a raft of changes on platforms with new features and new sort of, you know, everyone being default private, for example. If you were under 13, they have to do a bit of age verification. So that's coming a little bit as well. Not using nudge techniques to use persuasive design to keep you on platforms for long periods of time, that children have to know what's being done with their data. So it was a really good code. But what that showed is you can, if you implement the right legislation, you can make these companies make changes. And so getting the bill is really important because the bill will be the thing that forces the organisations to come to the table and do more. But we always say that they should be doing more. You know, we welcome their funding, we welcome their support of our programmes, but, you know, it really is long overdue that we fix some of the problems that we've got for young people online.
And I mean, the limitations of our legislation is that it's the World Wide Web. So, yes. You know, there are all sorts of ways of being able to access this kind of information because we don't control it all. And the platforms do, though. I mean, you know, if you say something on some platform, within a second, you're going to be barred and suspended and all that sort of stuff happens. So they seem to have the algorithms in place when they need them. But not necessarily when we need them in terms of the protection of young people. And of course, some would argue, is, you know, I think pornography, you know, brings in a lot of money for a lot of people. And, you know, if it's your business model that you want to maintain it on your system, you know, on your platforms, then, you know, there isn't the incentive, is there, Carolyn, to do as much about it at the speed we want them to do.
Yeah, the you know, my understanding from the commercial pornographers, and we don't really work with them at all, but my understanding is they're all ready to go. Their only thing was they need it to be on all platforms simultaneously so that no one loses out commercially, but they're ready. They say they're ready to go to put in different ways of age verifying. But yeah, you're right in that. Certainly, you know, if a service is free online, you're being monetized in some way, you know, whether that's the advertising that you're seeing, you know, whether that's your data being collected and used somehow, you are being monetized. And again, that's something we need to teach our children about, you know, what you're sharing. You know, one of the terms and conditions for Instagram, for example, is that Instagram can use all of your photos if you post them. And I don't know whether children know that. I doubt very much that they know that. And clearly Instagram aren't going to use every person's
photos. They
probably
don't care, do they?
But we should, again, going back to that point about critical thinking, encouraging young people to really think about what they're sharing, who they're sharing it with, and how the organisations are using their design technology to either keep them engaged on the platform for longer or capture more data or more information about them. And that was, I think that was really the purpose behind the Children's Code, was to try and stop that for young people. Because we've all had the thing where you put something in a basket and it follows you around for the next 3 weeks going, do you want to buy this? Are you sure you don't want to buy this? You know, we're being tracked with cookies, and you know, and the Children's Code was about trying to make that better for young people. So you know, and at the same time, as I say, we're just trying to teach them how to think critically about all of that so they can make sensible choices when they're online.
Carolyn, can I just ask you a couple of things? First of all, just pick up on that Instagram comment. So what's that? If you post a picture on Instagram, Instagram have the right to use that photograph in perpetuity?
Yeah, in their terms and conditions, which are very long, and I think I can't remember how many pages they are, but a legal firm, Shillings, worked with Five Rights, which are children's rights organisations. They distilled the Instagram terms and conditions down into language that a child would understand. And one of the points is that when you post a photograph, Instagram have the right to use that photograph and the right to do what they want with it. I'm not sure if it's forever. Still, it definitely was the case a couple of years ago when they did it. They may well have changed that now, but it certainly was true of a couple of years ago. So that, you know, I think it highlights none of us read the terms and conditions, if we're honest. We just sort of sign up blissfully to these things. And that's why it's super important for young people that we make sure that that inherently these technologies that they're using have safety by design at the heart of them, and that they have children's best interests at the heart of them.
So very practically, you find out your parent and you find out that either your child is watching pornography, or you feel that there's a point to which you need to talk to them. So they're not a young kid, they're age appropriate, they're teenagers. How do you start that conversation? What do you say?
I think you need to be open and honest about it. Try and find out what they've seen. Try and find out how it's made them feel. And then, you know, I would be talking about the fact that pornography doesn't represent real life sex. You know, it potentially gives you an unrealistic view of sex, the fact that it's often abusive and violent towards women, and that you know that probably gives you a leeway to talk about consent and making sure that your child understands what consent means. But I'd still think about, you know, maybe you know we want to put parental controls in place and think about what can be accessed in the home. You know, that one of the really good things that we have today is the parental controls from the broadband provider that are free, and they're on every broadband company's service, and you can choose strict, moderate, or light, or high, medium, low, whatever they all call them, and it allows you to block access to commercial pornography websites. So I would certainly suggest to all parents that, as a very basic, put those filters on, because then at least your children can't either accidentally, or if they're just curious, because obviously teens are sexually curious, they can't stumble across that information. I'd certainly do that.
But there comes a point, of course, when the question is yes, put them in at a certain stage, but actually, yeah, it's far more manageable, and it's the way to move forward to say, well, actually, do you know what, it is there, and of course you can gain access to it, but this is why you shouldn't, and these are some of the risks that go with it, or these some of the thought processes. Yeah. Because what we know with children, of course, is you put something in place to stop them from doing it, and they'll go somewhere else to do it.
Yes, we've certainly seen in research that teens, that a lot of teens realise that you can get a VPN and that bypasses parental controls, and so you can get round onto websites. You also have the fact as well, you know, there is porn on social media, on certain social media platforms. There's also OnlyFans, but there are a myriad of ways, as you say, that young people can access this material if they're seeking it out. So having those conversations about the appropriateness of that and how often you're going to be doing that, you know, I think it's so important to be open and transparent with young people about this subject, because, and about any of the subjects about issues that they find online, because what we find is, as a parent, if you react badly and you threaten to take the tech away or you take the devices away, you're exactly the point that children will then find sneaky ways of going to do it, because you're taking away, you know, what they really want to do. So it's much more successful to be calm and non-judgmental and basically talk to them about what they're doing, why they're doing it, what they're seeing, how it's making them feel. And then to, as I say, as a parent, just explain to them that, you know, it's not real life. It is unrealistic. It is often abusive. And that's not what normal relationships look like. You know, you can talk about the fact that people are doing it for money and that it's a commercial model. And so the content gets more and more extreme as you get drawn into the cycle of watching pornography. So I think it's really important that parents don't get afraid of those conversations and just be very calm, as calm as you can, you know, and as fact-based as you can, and just don't shy away from it.
Nazir, I want to talk about, and Caroline, let's talk a little bit about sexting. So sexting became a big issue, Nazir, didn't it, in relation to, you know, a few years ago, schools were really struggling with being able to deal with it. And I know the police came out and talked about, you know, the way that they were going to try and do it and not criminalize people. Let's just be clear what sexting is it?
Well, it's the sharing of indecent images. I think it's what Carolyn said about putting people under enormous pressure that they should behave in a certain way. It's, you know, in the adult world, be seen as harassment, you know, more than one instant, which causes you alarm and distress. But it's one of these things that can be anything and everything, but it's in essence, it's one individual or groups of individuals trying to control another, and using whatever means to try and exploit them in some way. And it has become, I mean, it's on industrial levels, hasn't it, Carolyn? I mean, I gave that figure earlier on about dick pics, as they call them, you know, the availability and access to telephones. I mean, I don't know. My children got their first smartphone, I think, when they were teenagers. But, you know, children much younger now have access to that kind of stuff. And so the material is flying around in its, you know, in industrial levels.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt you saw on Everyone's Invited the scale of kind of child on child, peer on peer kind of sexual abuse that's going on in schools is just a massive concern. It's sort of almost normalized for school children. You know, to your point, we know that the majority of girls have been asked to share a sexual image at school, and a fair chunk of boys as well. It's commonplace to talk about sending them. So as a parent, definitely talking about this issue is really, really important. Again, what we find in terms of, certainly when you survey young people, and so there's an element of, you know, how much of the numbers are true, how much of, you know, do people want to declare, but certainly what we see is that it rises with age. So, you know, it might be on average about 4% at 13 are doing it, but it's up to sort of 17-20% by the time you get to 15. But equally, as I said earlier, it's significantly higher for vulnerable children, because those vulnerable children, as you said, are not being listened to, are seeking attention, finding a home and a tribe of people to be with. So, or they might not have the maturity, if they've got special education needs, they might not have the maturity of thinking or the judgment to kind of know what's right and what's wrong. And so what you tend to find is people see those vulnerabilities and pick on those vulnerabilities and pressure those young people into sharing sexual images, whether that's for, you know, for favors, or, you know, we'll only talk to you if you send us an image. And then once that image is sent again, it's sort of a, for a lot of young people, and maybe as parents we don't want to hear this, they send an image and a lot of them say it's all for fun and I wanted to do it and nothing really bad happened. But for that cohort of young people that are being, you know, singled out and identified, the consequences are awful. You know, they're pressurized to send more, their pictures are sent around the school. You know, it's just horrific. It's a horrific thing to happen. And I think it's hugely important that schools get on top of this issue and start thinking about how we teach children about sexting, because frankly, just saying don't do it isn't the right answer, I don't think, because the cat's out of the bag and this is part of a societal thing as well. So we have to get into sort of teaching about consensual sharing of images and non-consensual sharing of images. You know, we have to get into getting, you know, children to really think about the reasons why someone is asking for an image and when it's okay to say no.
Do you think that's how being you discussed say no? In school? Carolyn, do you think that's being discussed in school then, or not enough?
Not enough, I don't think. I think we see by the numbers that it's not enough. And I think, you know, certainly the Ofsted report really sort of shone a light on quite how bad it is in some schools in the UK. So I think it's something that needs really urgent attention. And, you know, there are lots of great associated organisations like ours, other non-profits that are trying to sort of change the way these lessons are taught. So the PSHE Association, for example, they've got some great resources that schools can use with teenagers to teach about these things. But it's just such, it's so important, because it can, you know, for those that it happens to, it's just, it it can change their lives, the course of their lives, because it just makes their whole school life unbearable. You know, and we've certainly seen that with youngsters that we've seen come through the other side of it, that it just can be tragic.
And of course, the images are there for yes. eternity now. I mean,
yes,
they can't
and
be
also,
erased.
You know, that going back to this, you know, the worst side of it is that 3/4 of the imagery that the IWF, the Internet Watch Foundation, who are the sort of industry body that removes child sexual abuse, 3/4 of what they're removing now is self-generated imagery, predominantly from girls aged 11 to 13. So it's a huge issue that I think we all need to grapple with. And as parents, certainly parents can play a massive role in helping their young people understand what's appropriate about sending images and what's not.
We need to get people talking, don't we? We need to get parents talking. We need to get educators talking. We need to make sure that this is no longer a taboo subject. It's uncomfortable.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned the Ofsted report. I mean, Ofsted now have prioritised safeguarding as one of their things they inspect. So there's a recognition, seemingly, at the highest levels, but more needs to be done. And Carol is absolutely right. The appetite for change is there. And what we can't do, a lot of parents seem to think, oh, just switch off the Wi-Fi or take away the tablet. We think that, you know, that's going to solve it. Of course it doesn't. It's conversations. It's education that solves this issue, or will solve this issue. And, you know, I want to leave our podcast, if you will, with some hope, Carolyn, because it sounds really quite depressing that we are, I've used language like industrial issues and it's, you know, worldwide. Give us some hope, Carolyn.
Oh, look, you know, our organisation, we're really pro-tech. You know, there are such huge benefits that young people get from technology. You know, you think about the pandemic and how we all survived the pandemic, and we wouldn't have done that without connected technology, you know, and that's the same for young people. That the learning opportunities are massive, you know, the fun and the entertainment that, you know, I think back to my childhood, you know, you had one Saturday morning TV channel, you know, our kids get this amazing you know, rich and immersive space that they can play and grow up in. And you know, we're hugely pro-tech. And gaming is another one. You know, people get very worried about gaming. But again, lots of skills that are learned through gaming, teamwork, strategy, you know, and dealing with failure and all of those kinds of things. So there's massive opportunities with tech. We just need to get our house in order, and we need to get that regulation in place. We need to get the tech companies designing for children, you know, and at the same time, we need to carry on doing education with parents and with teachers so that young people have got those skills that they can really get the best out of the internet.
So, Carolyn, for our listeners, what resources do you offer and how do they find them?
So we've got a website called internetmatters.org. Everything is free at the website, and it's structured by age of your child, because obviously that matters. But there's lots of guides to social media, to gaming. There's guides if you've got particular issues that you're dealing with, whether that's bullying or sexting or, you know, viewing pornography. So we've got a wealth of information at internetmatters.org. So, you know, if you are a parent, I'd encourage you just to sort of have a look, because I'm sure there's something you will find there that will certainly help you with some of the conversations you need to have at home.
Brilliant. Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us. It was really valuable conversation, and hopefully people will keep it going. Nazir, really useful.
100%. I mean, what Carolyn and the rest of her colleagues are doing is absolutely essential. And the point she made about, you know, this, the middle classes seem to be able to deal with this. The problem we have is vulnerable, those who are the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because, as I've said before, they often are they're the ones that are targeted by the predators. And we've got to do much more in this field. And so, you know, all power to
Carolyn. Do you think there is a problem at times with societies, you know, different elements, different ethnicities in terms of culture?
There's also culture.
Difficult
culture
for them to talk.
Part. Of course it does. Culture plays a part. You know, we didn't explore it in any detail because we haven't got time. But, you know, some faith schools don't like the idea of having relationship education. Education at all. I mean, all faiths. And so immediately, you know, those children are.
There's no conversation being had, is there? No conversation being had.
Those children undoubtedly are a greater risk as a result of that. I mean, the reality is if you don't educate them, they're going to be, they are in a more dangerous place. So culture plays a part. You know, I think, but the reality is we know what works, and Carolyn has identify what works. It's proper education. It's proper tuning up of parents. It's parents having conversations. It's not trying to hide the problem. It's exposing the problem. And we know what works. We just need to make sure we've spoken before on our podcast about parents having the tools, but parents also need the time. Particularly we're now in a cost of living crisis where people are looking for a second job, a third job, whatever, you know, any job, because they are struggling. The last thing that's going to be on their mind, I guess, is what happens to their children. You know, here's a tablet, get on with it, because I just don't have time to look after you.
And if you're a parent, you're a grandparent, or you know people who've got children, you know, please just have that conversation with them. 5-10 minutes, just make the effort, because you never know, it could actually save somebody's life. So Nazir, we're not here next week. We are here the week after.
Yep.
You've got an interesting guest coming.
Yeah, we're being joined by David Collins. David is the Sunday Times writer. He's just won the Paul Foot Investigative Journalist of the Year Award. And he's written a book called The Silver Killers, which has just come out on, and it's, you know, it's doing pretty well on Amazon. And it's about, I won't tell you what it's about. I will let David Collins share it when we speak to him next.
Brilliant. Well, listen, fantastic. It was great to have Carolyn on board from Internet Matters. Please do go and check her site. Nazir, as always, fantastic. Please do continue to drop us a message. You know, ask us anything you want or point us in direction of areas or topics that you particularly want to talk about. And please do go to our website or for our Twitter page and subscribe. Until the week after next, look after yourself, take care, and we'll see you then. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.